Blog Talk Radio.
This week on Backroom Politics, breaking news out of Washington, the Gang of Five is now the Gang of Six, and oh, by the way, the president likes it. Is there anyone in England that wasn't involved with News Corp, the continued downward slide of media mogul Rupert Murdoch? How will this affect the American media market? Wait for it. More fiscal crisis coverage. This and the proper way to say certain Yiddish terms. All today on Backroom Politics. Tuesday here in Washington, D.C., in our nation's capital. It's 4 o'clock on the East Coast. That means it's time for America's premier cigar drinking and political roundtable. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, America's premier cigar tavern. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, to my left, noticeably missing, is 8-term Congressman Al Swift. He's out doing stuff in the Virgin Islands. For all we know, he's creating his own little empire down there, but we'll hear about that when he gets back. Joining me to my alternate left, and, well, that's actually kind of a neat pun. Joining me to my alternate left is he's a former presidential appointee to the EPA, former staffer for the Senate Environmental Committee. He is John Freshman. John, how you doing, sir?
Fine, thanks. Glad to be here. It's quite a day.
Joining me directly across from me, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be at Shelley's. It's the place to be.
It is the place to be.
On a hot day like this, it's great to be here.
It is nice to be inside, too. Yeah. It is hot out there. Joining me to my right, as he is every Tuesday, he is the director of China programs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in Washington, D.C., and the great city of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Great to be here. And I just want to say kudos to the U.S. women's soccer team for handling their defeat with such class and poise.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later on in the show, but we got some breaking news coming out of Washington. The big news right now is just when you thought the fiscal crisis couldn't get any worse or couldn't get any better or any more confusing, this out of Washington, breaking news is that apparently the Gang of Five is now the Gang of Six again. And they've come up with a plan that they had originally come up with, had tabled, brought it up again, and now apparently everybody likes it. John, do you know any of the details on the latest? Because we're just getting word in now.
Well, the substance of it is still a little bit up in the air. But as we know in politics, as in everything else in life, timing is everything. And with the essential collapse of the effort to try to reach a meaningful compromise in the House of Representatives, the action has shifted to the Senate and between President Obama and a number of senators on both sides, which is exactly what this society believes should happen and which is what most of us talk about all the time. It's going to look like the $4 trillion deal that was on the table before with some revenue enhancers.
Well, the deal that we're hearing about right now coming out of the Gang of Six, which, by the way, Senator Tom Coburn is back in play, which, Bob, you worked with Senator Coburn in previous years. What do you think brought him back to the table, just out of curiosity?
I think what brought him back to the table was an opportunity to help craft a final solution that he has been trying to craft for some time. He had his own proposal just recently he laid down, and he has been working with, his founding member of the Gang of Six. Even before there was a Gang of Six, he was on the floor of the Senate on a regular basis talking about the need to solve this problem, the whole budget deficit problem. So he has got a very long track record in this area, and I'm not surprised that he's being helpful here at the end when we really need some help.
Well, the deal that we're getting word of right now is that the Gang of Six proposal, as they're calling it, you know, it would be nice if we got some people to come in with some creativity to them. The Gang of Six proposal, they could have come up with some budget get-in, fiscal get-in, Armageddon redo, I don't care. But the Gang of Six proposal, as it stands right now, as it stands in everybody's hands, is a reduction of the deficit by $3.7 trillion over 10 years, basically $370 billion each year. In part, they would also include raising $1 trillion in new revenue. Now, Bob, you've been in this town a long time. When they report raising $1 trillion in new revenue, what does that scream in political ease?
Well, I think what they're doing, a lot of it is some of the tax expenditures are going to be reduced and cut down. But the most important thing about it is that they're in there. I think it's very important that you can't cut programs and get us where we have to go. We have to have revenues. And we have to have substantial revenues. The fact that the Gang of Six has put it on the table and people seem to be saluting is a wonderful thing. It's going to be a tough slog in the House, even with support from on a bipartisan basis in other places. It is very difficult to see it getting through the House. I believe that one of the reasons that the Speaker is having a vote this week on the constitutional amendment budget program is in order to give the Tea Party folks another vote that they want, so that maybe a few of them will be willing to come along and help pass the Gang of Six proposal.
Well, you know, this brings... Oh, go ahead, Ralph.
I was going to say that the Tea Party is going to have to realize that the polls are starting to turn against them, that Americans want some sort of compromise in raising the debt limit.
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about that here. We're going to talk about some polling numbers that are starting to hit the street as late as today. Well, let's go back and talk about this Gang of Six approach. It is the odd thing about it is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell never really got on board with the Gang of Six proposal, even from the beginning. But now it seems that they're giving it a lukewarm reception. They still have their kick the can down the road approach, but that's an appropriate plan B, I think, is how the president said. It's a good backup, I think, was his direct quote. Bob, first of all, they're going to have a hard time passing this through the House, but it sounds like they're going to have an even tougher time in the Senate, which is a kind of a reversal of fortunes. We always thought that the House would be the tough one. What's going to make it so hard in the Senate?
Well, I don't think it's going to be easy in either House. I think the value of the McConnell and Reid proposal, quite frankly, was everybody looked at it and realized, if that's the best we could do, it's not enough. We're going to have to get something more. And I think maybe that had something to do with the revival of and the support of the Gang of Six approach.
And by the way, for those of you out there that are listening, you can call in and join the conversation. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, the number is 619-638-8477. We'd love to have you join the discussion. Let's go, John, to you. Do you agree with Bob that this is going to have a hard time in both sides, but I still think indications are going to be the House is going to be an easier sell than the Senate in this case?
Oh, I don't think that's right at all. I think this is a Senate-driven proposal originated by a bipartisan group that includes Durbin and Kent Conrad from North Dakota and Saxby Chambliss, one of the most reasonable men in the Senate. Coburn is back in. McConnell's certainly not going to lead a filibuster. He'd rather have the Gang of Six thing than his Plan B. I don't think it's going to be that hard to do in the Senate. Jim DeMint is going to filibuster it from South Carolina. But if you have the majority leader and the minority leader standing up in favor of, which they're certainly going to do, you're not going to have a successful filibuster. They'll achieve cloture.
Any word on why you think that Senator Coburn came back to the table? Was it just personal calling? Was it a request by maybe the president calling and saying, look, I need you back to the table? Any word on your end?
I have heard Senator Coburn say publicly on a TV interview that he is a good friend of Obama's and that they are very fond of each other. Whether or not, I hope there was a conversation. I don't know whether there was one or not.
Okay.
And then I think he, you know, the reaction that he got from Grover Norquist sort of made him more determined than ever to create some sort of bipartisan compromise.
What do you mean?
He got very angry and upset with Grover Norquist coming out against him for violating the tax pledge that he signed. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're going to talk about that tax pledge in a little bit further down the road. But looking back at the Gang of Six deal right now, and Bob, John, Gang of Six, it is, who are the Gang of Six? Do we recall offhand?
It's
Coburn, obviously.
It's, on the Democratic side, Conrad and Durbin and is it Reed?
No.
Sorry.
I'm not sure.
Hold on. We'll find out. We'll go.
Chambliss and Coburn.
Coburn and
Corker from Tennessee. That's right. There we go.
Who's
the sleepy dwarf? We always get six of the dwarves. We never get the seventh one.
Maybe someone can call in and tell us.
We should know this being political insiders, but we got other stuff to worry about too. It's a big inside ball. But anyway, when you look at the just with the names that we've mentioned, I mean, those are some pretty well-rounded, well-versed people from playing inside baseball, Washington style. And you had the Vice President, Joe Biden, who's about as inside baseball as they come. What makes this different now than it did 6 months ago, or 3 months ago, or even 4 weeks ago?
Timing.
Why? Go ahead.
We are at the edge of the cliff. One more step and we fall over. And I think people have finally come to realize that that's the case. I think it's also helpful that the polls are beginning to show that the public is aware of what's going on, and they're ready to blame some people.
Well, you know, when you look at the polls that are coming out, just right now, a generic congressional ballot put out by Rasmussen has 44%. Republican, 38% favor Democrats. There's still a large gap of undecided in there. You're also looking at, but on the same token, Rasmussen also puts out a poll that says voters rate Republicans in Congress more partisan than congressional Democrats. But in total, only 25% of Americans feel like we're going in the right direction. Do you think that number resonates with everybody in Washington right now, or was this? Because one of the things they heard is, and just to tell a quick story, I was giving a speech yesterday at Georgetown to a group of political science students, had about 100 of them in the room. When we asked them, you know, what do you think about what's going on? What's your understanding of the fiscal deficit crisis? Every answer was different, which goes back to what we've been talking about for the past few weeks. There's no messaging. There's no consistent message coming out of Washington on this program. But when you ask them who do they feel is a bigger hurdle, they feel it's the Republicans.
Well, I think the reason they do feel it's the Republicans is because most of the problems have come out in the news media this way. The Democrats have offered these cuts and have asked the Republicans to provide to give on taxes. And the Republicans have drawn a line in the sand that is extremely firm and rigid, and they haven't wanted to move at all. And so it's easy to say the Republicans are the ones who are the most rigid and the most obstructionist.
John, let me just read a short quote from Ross Douthat in the New York Times, which supports Bob's point. Their inability to make even symbolic concessions has turned a winning hand into a losing one.
And this is the problem with the Tea Party. They do not want to compromise on anything.
That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And that's going to hurt the Republican Party down the line
Bob,
if they don't get these people on.
Bob.
Weeks ago, there were good proposals out that had, you know, literally $4 billion in cuts, and they were looking for some money Democrats were willing not to go with rates so much changes, but they were willing to look at tax expenditures, which are fundamentally what we would call earmarks. things in the tax code that have that give support and benefits to individuals or small groups that other people don't have. And they are very valuable to those groups, but they're not valuable to the average citizen. The Tea Party people looked upon, because they are taking a position that they have all signed the Grover Norquist Pledge, that a tax expenditure is an increase in taxes when you cut it, when you remove it, because it means people have to pay more taxes because they no longer have their tax break. Now, the fact of the matter is that is a very big stretch. And the fact is, we have to have some revenues. We had opportunities early on, and the Republican Tea Party folks were pretty sharp here. And it would have been to their benefit, I think, to find a way to move in the area of letting some of the tax expenditures expire, be removed from the tax code, in exchange in the future for when we do a major overhaul of the tax law, which will probably come in the next 18 months or 2 years. It will reduce the tax rate.
But when you look at that, there are so many, and this is probably part of the problem with the tax code as a whole, is letting a tax loophole or a tax break sunset, is that a tax increase? Well, it depends. You know, nobody's given us a straight answer yet. You talk to the Grover Norquist Tea Party side, they say that's absolutely an increase in taxes. You look at the Democrats, they say, no, it's not. You're already paying that. All you're doing is putting it in general revenue instead of having to put it somewhere else in an earmarker elsewhere.
Absolutely. If I had a 40% tax credit off of my income tax to show up at Shelley's back room every 2 weeks and have fun talking to you guys, I'd probably hire a lobbyist to keep it for me. And if you take it away from me and I pay the same amount of taxes as Bob Hines, I don't know how any sane person can call that a tax increase. I don't think there is a debate, respectfully, on this subject.
Well, you've got tax attorneys throughout Washington on the Tea Party side saying, no, if you look at tax code, as it stands right now, tax code is clear.
It's a tax increase.
It, according to them. Now then, somewhere in the middle, I think, might be the truth. I mean, the reality is, when you look at the current situation, you cannot plan on, you can make all the cuts you want. Cuts are great. That all that does is just decrease the future bill. What you've got is a situation of, we still got to pay off that old bill. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is to have some sort of revenue stream. The question now is, what is that revenue stream? And I think that's going to be the hindrance of what the two parties are going to be arguing about going forward. Is that accurate, Bob?
I don't think there's any doubt that the Tea Party people are going to complain about any tax increase, because they feel very strongly about it, period.
Ralph?
I think if you look for a revenue stream, you have to look at how much money is being held offshore and see about effective ways to repatriate that money back into the United States.
But that's only one part.
It may be only one part, but it's a start.
Because there's a lot
of money overseas that you could bring it back here would help to generate.
I absolutely agree. But the reality is, and John, you had a thought going into that as well.
Well, there is a package of tax expenditure that's in the Gang of Six. It's always been in the Gang of Six, and I assume that's going to form the core of whatever gets moved forward. And the president is willing to agree to it.
But I don't think
the position of the Tea Party or Grover Norquist on the issue of taxes is important anymore. I think they have lost. They're not part of this discussion.
I absolutely disagree with you, John. I will tell you right now. Look, Grover Norquist doesn't have the ear of a lot of the Republican Party for no reason. I mean, he's got stroke with the party. But whether you like it or not, that's reality. I don't think
this issue right now.
What's that?
This compromise.
They're going to vote against it anyway. It's the biggest issue on the table.
They're going to vote against it anyway. You have to find a majority without them.
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens to the pledge after this either passes or fails, because I think we're at a crossroads here. I think Grover Norquist, nobody has been willing to defy him.
But I
and
go back.
Now this is the first time.
But I go back to the original question. What is different about the Gang of Six now that was different other than we were literally rocking on the edge of the brink of disaster. Nobody has been able to answer that question.
Why do you have to answer any more than that? The fact of the matter is, if you believe that it is the brink of a disaster, then some of your strongly held views have to be modified. You have no choice.
But here's the funny thing about that, though, Bob, is the amount. I mean, America's blood pressure could have decreased tenfold if cooler heads had prevailed early on and said the Gang of Six, or even I'm starting to hear now. They're starting to bring back the Paul Ryan budget as a possible idea.
The business community is starting to get very active in this debate, which they weren't initially.
Well,
and people are starting to take notice and recognizing that, look, people have to compromise in order to get this done.
That's great. The business community, that's great. I love the fact that the American Chamber is getting active finally. That's fine with me. Whether they're right or wrong, at least they're coming up with a voice. I still go back to the question is, what is different now that cooler heads couldn't have prevailed and we didn't have to get to the brink of absolute disaster? Because there's a lot of other important items on the table as soon as this is done.
Well, remind yourself of this. Number one, the president did not engage at all until several weeks ago directly in a public way, number one. Number two, in both parties, particularly in the House, you have a lot of people on both sides who are very, very, very strongly confirmed in their own views. That's the Tea Party people on the right and the more liberal Democratic majority, the large majority in the House. So you've got in effect a very difficult situation because neither one of them wanted the blink. Neither side wanted the blink, and the president wasn't asking anybody to blink when he put out his budget and he put out his State of the Union address. The fact of the matter is, we now have a situation where everybody realizes how difficult it's going to be, and nobody knows how bad it's going to be, but everybody knows it's going to be a mess if we default. And now, at least a few people at the leadership level have seen it and said we've got to do something, and hopefully some of the more enthusiastic people on both sides of the aisle on their own point of view will realize that they have to bend a little bit in order to avoid something that may destroy their own political future.
Let's hold that thought. We're coming up. We're past the 20-minute mark. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to follow up on that comment right there. Hold that thought, Bob. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
come over.
And we're back here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. It's unfortunate. Some of the best discussions we have are sometimes during the break, and those are great topics to bring up. But we want to go back to the breaking news out of Washington. Apparently, there might be. Now, here's the thing is, we say this, and it's almost like crying wolf. You know, I can't tell you the number of media markets I've seen or the media experts I've seen that come out and said, oh, we're close to a deal, we're close to a deal, and then it just gets destroyed. So I'm going to say this, but take it with a grain of salt. Breaking news out of Washington is the Gang of Six deal, which would cut $3.7 trillion over 10 years and have a revenue increase of $1 trillion over the same time frame, has apparently gotten wide acceptance as being the go-to deal right now in Washington to fix the fiscal crisis. Now then, again, take it with a grain of salt. But one of the questions, John, that you asked that I would pose to Bob is, where does Speaker Boehner get his majority to get this through?
Well, he's got 87 freshmen came in. Probably two out of three, at least, are Tea Party people. He's got to get some of them. I think that the Democrats in the House will, well, let's say when the vote comes to the floor of the House, I expect the Democrats will probably hold back and not vote for the most part. And the Democrat leadership will say, let's see if they've got 185, 190 votes. They'll have to get pretty close to that before people like Steny Hoyer will say, well, you know, this is the best we're going to get. We're going to have, some of us are going to have to vote there. We're going to have to get the 218, and then they're going to have to find 30 or 40 Democrats. I think that's where it's going to be. And John Boehner is going to have, and Eric Cantor, and they are working together here. They are going to have to find, basically, pretty close to 180, 85 votes, Republican votes, which means some Tea Party people are going to have to say, we're at the brink, we're at the crisis, we have to vote. We've had all the votes we've had three or four good votes, but from the first of the year through voting for the constitutional amendment this week, we've had opportunity to vote to tell people back home we did everything we could, we pushed as hard as we could, but we can't let the country default.
Okay, but on the same token, I go to you, John, and say, where is Nancy Pelosi going to get enough opposition to shoot this down?
Well, I don't think she's going to try to shoot it down. I think she's smarter than that. I want you to remember one thing. Most of those new Republican seats that came transitioned from Democrats were Democrats who tended to be moderate conservative Democrats from swing districts. What's left in the Democratic caucus?
Give me an example.
Those two guys from Arkansas that lost.
So you're saying those.
What's left is a much more liberal caucus than you had before, and there's no way in the world that they're going to provide the votes for this unless they get some concessions of some kind, because heretofore they don't feel like they've been at the table.
Well, it's odd, because, you know, traditionally in politics that I knew, is if you were going to try and shoot something down, you had one of your own plans as a backup to immediately, second that cleared vote, you went in there and went, boom, here's my proposal. And the Democrats don't have that.
They're not going to try to shoot it down.
You really, you don't think that there's going to be opposition to this on a liberal side?
I don't think there's going to be organized opposition from the leadership in the House of Representatives on this.
No, Bob, I know that Pelosi is known to crack the whip and bring people in line when she needs to.
Bob, do you agree with that?
The minority leader of the House of Representatives, the former Speaker, Ms. Pelosi, doesn't have to say a word, because left to their own devices, 90% of the Democrats who are members of the Democratic caucus probably are going to be, would have to be dragged screaming and kicking into supporting as many cuts as going to be in this, is this proposal. So the fact of the matter is, all the Democrats have, leadership has to do, is sit back and see how many Republicans say aye. And then at some point they'll say, okay, people who feel they have to go with the country and get this thing through, let's go ahead with it.
But how divisive is this going to, I mean, is this truly going to bring the Republican Party as we know it to a critical breaking point, either either we save it or
it could.
The party's going to be beholden to the Tea Party down the road.
It could be a very serious break in the party if we have a situation where the leadership in both houses wants to solve the problem and the membership does, and enough of the membership doesn't, so we fail. Now, if we get very, very close, let's say we're over 205 or something like that, 210. We're close. Some Democrats have come in, but not very many. At that point, if we get very close and we still lose, you know, we're going to have a situation where the leadership on both sides will say, well, you know, to the other side, if a few more votes of yours had come over, we could have solved the problem. I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't expect we'll get real close and then not make it. If we get real close, we'll get over the top.
Ralph.
Cantor's desire is to become the next speaker, so it's in his interest to cultivate the Tea Party.
Sure.
Now,
it is.
What, as you said, if they do get very close, what do you think will happen? Do you think Cantor is going to go along, or will he remain intransigent?
The idea that Eric Cantor and John Boehner are at odds now, they have different political futures, but remind yourself, Cantor is a good decade younger than Mr. Boehner. Mr. Boehner's speakership, no matter how long he wants it and has it, if he wants it forever, he's still not going to want to be speaker into his 70s. I know, John, that he's got family. He's not going to want to do it. The fact of the matter is, Cantor's going to be speaker if the Republicans are in the majority. If the Republicans lose the majority, he's going to be the minority leader.
Okay,
Who wants to be the minority leader?
But here's the problem, though. Dave Camp is quoted this afternoon as saying, quote, I would have a problem with $1 trillion in new revenue. That is a hurdle that's going to put this whole deal in jeopardy. How do you get somebody? And Dave Camp's not exactly that far right. He's pretty moderate in many instances. This one, he sounds like he's standing firm on. Is it showboating for the media, or is this going to put the deal in jeopardy, John?
The $1 trillion number that has been bandied about as the Gang of Six number is very soft. I don't know anybody who knows what's in it. I'm not sure the president has endorsed what's in it. That's the area when you're going to see a lot of back and forth, and I think we should wait and see what's inside that $1 trillion before we rush to judgment about it.
Will it be out on the internet for people to view? I mean, that was one of the things.
I don't think anything's firm on paper right now.
Is anybody going to be able to read anything in any of this before it's passed?
Well, but that was the whole issue of other bills, like the health care bill. That you have to read everything.
But that's happened every time. That's old school Washington. But the question I have now is, so we have a vote. We have a vote on next Tuesday, I believe. Okay. On the cupcake proposal, which is cut, cap, and balance, which is the alternate plan, the backup plan. They're going to vote on that. And apparently as soon as they vote on it, Obama's calling them back to the White House. Shouldn't they be working out that deal now instead of waiting a week and waiting for cupcake to go through?
Again, the deal originates in the Senate, not in the House. There's not going to be any cupcake in the Senate.
It's going to go to the Senate floor. If the House can get
two-thirds?
That's the big question. That's the big question. Because, I mean, you've got the majority leader and the minority leader both on board with cup, cap, and balance. I keep wanting to call it cupcake. And so you have the Senate majority leader and the Senate minority leader. You've got the president actually coming out and saying, you know, it's not necessarily a bad idea, but it's a good backup. That's got to give it some wings, at least in the Senate, if it passes the House, which it sounds like it might.
Yeah, but in the House, it includes the constitutional amendment on the balanced budget. I mean, that completely changes everything, and certainly Reid's not on board that. And
neither is McConnell.
On cut, cap, and balance.
Well, they're packaged together for the vote in the House.
Correct. So they pass it in the House, they're going to take it, and they're not going to... I mean, this thing could possibly go to conference.
No, the Senate will defeat it
if
they vote on it, and I assume they will just to make a point.
Do you think the Senate will give it a stand-up vote, an up-and-down vote?
I don't know. I don't know what Reid's plan is.
So they won't try and mark it off first, then.
I would think that they will. Whatever the House sends over will either be voted on or just left to die.
If the House sends over anything.
Yeah.
Correct. But... One of the good quotes coming out of the White House is the president saying, that the plan is broadly consistent with the approach that I've urged. What it says is we've got to be serious about reducing discretionary spending in both domestic spending and defense. The great thing about it is he says that it's broadly consistent with the approach that he's urged. When has he urged this? John, you're a Democrat. When has the president urged that? When have we heard that come out of his mouth? Except for maybe the past week.
Since he became active, he has been urging, and for a while, Boehner was also supportive of using this opportunity to do a grand plan and get cuts in entitlement and some sort of revenue expenditures to try to begin to go down the road for curing the deficit. That was broadly agreed to until the defection of the Tea Party. And the president has been urging that, including the $4 trillion, and he has put entitlement cuts on the table, which has fractured the Democrat Party, which nobody talks about, you know, the left and the liberals and the fact that they are having, you know, much heartburn about this deal. They just talk about the right because the right gets all the attention, but I'm sure there's 85 or more Democrats who hate this thing.
But the Democrats seem to be able to hold themselves together. It's the Republicans and the Tea Party that are dividing themselves.
It's a problem to have the majority sometimes.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you know, here's the trick also is apparently Wall Street loves this deal because as of right now, right after the close, the Dow was up 202 points. So that's got Wall Street now back in favor with Capitol Hill. That and breaking news is that apparently they had to stop trading Apple stock on the NASDAQ today as they delivered results. iPad sales nearly tripled over the past quarter. So they had to stop trading on Apple. That's going to get ugly. We'll talk about that probably next week. But for a rise of 202 points, Bob, you've been around the markets and politics for a long time. That's got to be a glowing endorsement for the Gang of Six plan. Or are we reading too much?
Well, let's say maybe it's a glowing recommendation for the plan today. But tomorrow, if, as an example, you discovered, well, if Wall Street discovered that carried interest is in the plan and they're cutting that out, I think Wall Street would change its mind, but it would still be a good plan.
It would still be a good plan, but
what he's talking about is the fact that under the current situation, hedge fund managers get a tax break on the money they make for managing. They don't pay ordinary income tax on the money they make for managing hedge funds.
Ralph, I want to talk now, if the stock market's obviously giving it a glowing endorsement, by the way, thanks for that, our financial analyst in-house, John Brennan. Ralph, the Dow obviously likes this. The NASDAQ was up 61 points. Standard & Poor's 500 was up just over 1.5%. Sure. That's got to play well overseas. How's that going to look in overseas market? Are we going to see the FTSE, the DAX, and everybody respond in kind to this?
I think so. I think it will have an effect on the international markets. Everyone overseas is taking a wait-and-see approach to determine how the U.S. is going to come to grips with getting their fiscal situation in order. And I think, obviously, the Gang of Six plan is a very good start, but we'll have to see if the plan gets passed.
Does this make China take a second look as far as devaluing their currency or even going away from a dollar market?
I certainly think it's a step in the right direction, but you know they're very concerned about the dollar and about our fiscal situation. There's no ands, buts, or ors about that, and they're going to do everything in their interest to protect their investment in our currency.
Okay,
let's don't make too much of the Gang of Six per se, although there's a bunch of good guys in there.
Right.
As you said earlier, Justin, they've been working on this for a long time. It's come to the fore now because obviously it has a tacit support of the president and McConnell and Reid, and that's why it's back on the table, because the timing is good and because the grand plan is unavailable in the House of Representatives.
But we're here on the 19th of July. We literally have less than 10 days, and theoretically we've already passed the point of no return, because according to Secretary Geithner, this deal needs to be done by Friday, and to have staff work out all the details to actually get a bill on the floor. So we're getting real close to ground zero on this part,
right? I mean, on August 2nd, we could still pay our bills, but...
Can we? We
still could, but it's a very dangerous situation to leave it to the very end.
Well, theoretically, depending on who you talk to, there's economists out there that say August 2nd, we don't have the money to pay our bills.
Just for a few weeks. Then after that...
I missed my mortgage payment. They're reporting that. They're reporting that to the credit bureaus.
The bottom line is the whole world is not going to collapse on August 2nd. However, by within a couple of weeks, if you do not have a plan in place, the system could really suffer a major collapse.
Okay.
There's no question about that.
Well,
the international community knows it.
When we come back, we're going to change focus a little bit. We're going to talk about the other big news ticket item today is Rupert Murdoch gave testimony today to a committee in Parliament where there was some drama inside the committee room there in Whitehall where a man apparently tried to foam pie Rupert Murdoch during testimony. Interesting video, but since you're on radio, we'll give you theater of the mind. John Prestman will be playing Rupert Murdoch today, and we will be...
At least our politics are consistent.
Wow, nice.
Give me a cream pie.
There we go, and the fun begins. When we come back, we're going to talk about News Corp and Rupert Murdoch. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. To the
And we're back here live at Chili's Back Room in Washington, D.C. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. Joining me, John Freshman, Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I'm your moderator, J.T. Russell. Folks, the other big news story coming out of global politics, and it actually has got some impact on American politics, is this situation with News Corp and the downward slide of News Corp International, News Corp as a whole, and in particular, the head of News Corp, Rupert Murdoch. The wake of destruction that follows Rupert Murdoch now includes the head of Scotland Yard, the chief of police for Metropolitan Police Department in London. The head of Scotland Yard resigned abruptly on Sunday after it was let out that he had some questionable dealings with News Corp under his watch, to the point where there might have been even financial transactions involved. There's still fallout coming from that. The other big news item associated with it is the original whistleblower on the phone hacking scandal was found dead in his apartment last night. And Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard is calling it not suspicious. So it was widely known that he had been in poor health, but it does beg the question, wow, this is way too coincidental. And just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that they're not after you. First question that comes to mind is, and we're watching video of Rupert Murdoch, his son John, and the pieing incident. We'll talk about that later on, but let's talk about the greater impact on this. News Corp has effectively lost about 21-22% of its total value, costing Rupert Murdoch hundreds of, if not billions of dollars. And it also brings into question the sustainability of the current day media as we know it. Number one, is this the downfall of Rupert Murdoch? Bob, you've been around the media all your life.
I don't think it's the end of Rupert Murdoch, but if any of the allegations in England, in Great Britain, also exist over here, if they have some problems over here, or if he is found to have been, you know, doing anything himself personally knowledgeable about some of these violations over in Great Britain, it may be that there will be repercussions here. Murdoch's interest of the United States, in addition to his newspaper, Wall Street Journal and the New York Post, he's got some electronic interests that are very valuable, and some of them require FCC licenses.
Now, let's hold off on that. I want to talk about the legality of that, because this brings up a whole new different. The testimony today could have impact on the future of news outlets, including Fox News.
It could.
But let's hold off on that. Real quickly, let's talk about what's going on in the hearings today. The BBC is reporting that a very humbled Rupert Murdoch rejects blame, saying that he was let down by, quote-unquote, people I trusted. Is Rupert Murdoch just a figure? I mean, is he just a leader of, and he does have some culpable deniability that he really didn't know, this is just normal practice for years? Or does he have to be held accountable, John?
Come on, he's a hands-on executive who built a gigantic media empire. One thing we learned in Watergate, and we learn over and over and over and over and over and over again, it's always about the cover-up. It's not about the action. And when all the layers of the onion are pulled back on this, the fact that he didn't know about it is almost laughable.
Really? Ralph?
Right. I mean, he's the top dog. The buck stops with him. He should have known, and he should have acted to rectify the situation immediately.
Well,
one of the big issues is whether he has violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second. But theoretically, right now, you've got Rupert Murdoch, who is literally going hands off, saying, "Look, you know, I trusted these people. These people took it upon themselves to do what he has called dirty journalism, and he was caught, quote unquote, according to Rupert Murdoch, his hands were caught dirty. But he still comes across as saying, look, there has to be some individual responsibility to the journalists. They took it upon themselves to do this.
But that doesn't absolve him of his responsibility.
Bob?
My view would be this. Now, this is not a few instances in a relatively short period of time. This is something, this hacking has been going on apparently for a number of years with a number of very high-level people in the company aware of it, or should have been aware of it, most likely were aware of it. But the fact of the matter is, it's pretty hard for me to believe that his top people didn't know about it. The people who were running the operations, his newspaper operations there in London over the past few years, have been very close to him personally. How they wouldn't have indicated, you know, where they got the scoop, how they were able to pull this off, you know, sort of in a, boy, Rupert, we really pulled another one off. I would be surprised if he didn't know something was going on. Now, he may have not realized how serious it was, but I doubt it. I have a feeling that he knew a great deal about what was going on. Maybe not all the details, but he certainly knew that they were skating awful fast on some awfully thin ice.
Well, the latest on that, I mean, you talk about the senior leadership. Over the weekend, Rebecca Brooks, the head of News Corp International and the leader of the News of the World at the time that these hackings occurred, she was arrested. She says that even though she did not directly know about it, she'd heard about it, but her quote is, she acted, and News International had acted quickly and decisively when evidence of the hackings emerged. Do you buy that story, John?
No.
No.
I mean,
I don't buy the fact that they didn't know, and the strategy of denial never, ever, ever works, and it's not going to work here.
It reeks of a cover-up is what this is coming down to.
It's very fair to say that as soon as it became public, they acted quickly. It is not fair to say that the first time they knew what was going on, even if, let's say, if it was at a lower level, the first time the top echelon knew what was going on, I do not believe that they said, oh my God, we got to stop this immediately. I think they looked the other way.
What a slap in the face to impartial journalism. I mean, this is going to reverberate around the media.
You can't look at tabloid journalism in England, which has been around for years. You have the Mirror. You have the News of the
perception.
World. They have been doing crap like this for decades.
Okay.
It has always been. That is what has kept the Sunday print tabloid media every week alive. They got dirt on actors and actresses and celebrities and politicians. You know, you look at even the political sex scandals of the Tories back in the 70s and early 80s. It was the tabloids who broke it because it makes it
Profumo.
Sell. What's that?
Profumo was the guy.
You look at, and that's what sells newspapers. So the British public has certain sort of culpability in this because they bought into it. They loved that. They loved waking up in the morning and seeing the News of the World going, oh, look, you know, all of a sudden, ex-celebrity was caught in ex-sex scandal. I got to read about this.
But the issue is the hacking. That's gotten a lot of people very upset and concerned
but
they hacked into someone's phone.
Well, and a 14-year-old dead girl.
Yeah,
that's the issue.
That's the one that killed it.
Yeah. Nobody had a problem when they were hacking Hugh Grant's phone. Nobody had a problem
because he's a celebrity.
Nobody had a problem when they were going into former Exchequer, former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. They had no problem when they were going in and hacking into Gordon Brown's son's medical records. They didn't have a problem reading about that. But the death of a 14-year-old girl, the British public has a certain culpability because they say, "Oh, wait a minute, that's just too much. Now this has to stop." They'll still be buying tabloids next Sunday.
Sure they will.
So isn't there an inherent hypocrisy in all this?
Well,
Bob, as a former vice president, as a former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters, I would love your take on this.
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a certain amount of hypocrisy, but that's human nature. I mean, you know, nobody thinks that, you know, that it's a bad thing to catch you know, these celebrities and stars doing things that people think, you know, oh, they like to go, oh, my goodness, isn't that terrible? Tee-hee, isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way it is. That's true here. Look at the kind of magazines that make a big stink, that make a big popularity over here. People magazine, U.S. People or whatever they are. I don't even know what the names of them are, but there's about a half a dozen of them.
Okay,
and
magazine.
And they're the most popular magazines in America, I think.
Yeah. But you look at, but then you look at TMZ on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, they do ambush journalism there. You've got, but all of that was crafted on the British tabloid methodology of no holds barred. Hey, by the way, we'll get the story for you, and you're going to love reading about it. But the question I still go back to is, does this bring down Rupert Murdoch? Because there's already been talk amongst board members about replacing Rupert Murdoch as chairman of News Corp. Is that a reality, John?
I think it's going to have a profound and serious effect on him and his ability to run that company, and more importantly, his ability to pass it on to his son, who was present in all of these conversations and who's part of everything, whatever everything turns out to be. He's not going to be able to just hand this over and keep it in the family. With respect to the tabloid journalism comment, which was well taken, these guys also own the Wall Street Journal, one of the most respected papers in the world. Collateral damage is something
to
watch.
Hold on that. We're going to talk about that at the top of the hour. I want to bring that up because the ripple effect on this is going to be huge, to the point where it could take down an entire media set here in the U.S.
What about Fox News?
We're going to talk about all that. So when we come back at the top of the hour, we're going to talk about the effects of what's happening in Great Britain with News Corp here in the United States. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. back here in Washington, D.C. It is the top of the hour, and this is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me every Tuesday as he is the former EPA presidential appointee. He is the former staffer for the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Senate. He is John Freshman. To my direct opposite, he is the former floor chief for Gerald Ford in the House of Representatives. He is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines and the director of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center and bar certified attorney in Washington, D.C. in the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. I am your moderator, J.T. Russell, and we're going to continue to talk about the News Corp fiasco going on overseas in London. As we look at the big screen in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics, CNN is showing pictures of Rupert Murdoch. Eventually, they're going to show a picture of Rupert Murdoch up there with his son, John, testifying in front of a parliamentary committee in Whitehall. He got foam pie today in a really awkward moment in British politics, but it is British politics. Strange stuff happens in Whitehall. When we were talking about the ramifications, the business ramifications of what's going on in England for News Corp. The question we have now is, how does this scandal in England affect Rupert Murdoch and News Corp here in the U.S.? Bob, you were talking about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as being in play in this. Can you talk about that for a second?
Well, I don't know what, if anything, what Murdoch will be found to be responsible for or guilty of. But I would assume that if he is found to be culpable, knowledgeable, and put it under the table, I would think that there will be a group of interest in the United States who will want to go to the FCC as an example, and in effect, suggest to the FCC that the licenses that the Murdoch's corporations hold with respect to satellite broadcast and others should be withdrawn. And that could be the most damaging blow that he could possibly have, because I don't know that his newspapers make that much money, but I know for a fact that Fox News is a huge, huge moneymaker.
And if John, they do that, that will be literally be the end of Murdoch's empire.
John Lee, Fox News, obviously very, very far to the right as far as media outlets go. When we talk about the impact of Fox News and News Corp being under the jurisdiction or the auspices of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that's got to bring into question something that you brought up, the credibility of Fox News. It brings up the credibility of the Wall Street Journal. There's a lot of credibility issues facing Rupert Murdoch right now.
I think there's a lot of credibility, and I think the more he gets into what appears to be an initial effort to try to deny involvement and deny responsibility, the worse it's going to get. You know, it's going to be just the shoes on the other foot, and all of a sudden he's going to be subject to leak, 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 drip, drip, drip. This thing's going to come out slowly. It's inconceivable to me that he didn't know about it. It's almost always about the cover-up from Watergate forward, almost always about the cover-up, and it brings a lot of big guys down. And he's a big guy. I think he's in real trouble. We'll have to see what happens.
Does Fox News inherently right now lose credibility?
Oh, I don't know that Fox News loses credibility, but I can see where people who maybe are hit on by Fox News could say, look, this is just another case of what they're doing in England. And then suddenly it could become
as an impromptu defense against any of the credibility of Fox News.
Exactly.
So when Nancy Pelosi is hammered by Fox News, she can come back and go, well, they probably hacked into my phone, calling into question the credibility.
Yeah.
And you have to look at how advertisers react if they're going to pull.
Is that legitimate, though, John?
Well, I think that if you're, you know, the tabloid newspaper, or if you're Fox News, or if you're the Patrick O'Donnell show, and you spend a lot of time throwing out assertions and allegations. Anything is fair. Anything's credible. It's wide open. And absolutely, and it's fair game. You know, he's wounded, and people aren't going to say, oh, geez, he's such a nice guy. We really liked him. He's wounded. They're going to attack, and there's going to be blood on the water. And he's not passing this thing along to his son either, I can tell you that.
Well, the talk is that they're talking about giving this over to their COO, John Murdoch, Rupert's son, although his closest advisor in News Corp. It's been largely believed that he will not take over the helm, but even then he would have a credibility problem going forward.
Just a question of how long till they bring in a credible, reputable outsider to take over the helm and clean it up. How long, not whether.
Well, now, I mean, the ripple effect right now, I mean, Rupert Murdoch also, they're saying that this journalism, this type of journalism has impacted the old gray lady of England, the London Times. The London Times has been largely a reputable media outlet in Britain, but now people are saying, "Well, wait a minute, they've fallen prey to the same thing." Is that a fair attack, Ralph, on the London Times?
I think all of these newspapers in the UK are going to come under some level of scrutiny. And the interesting thing is, what kind of answers did Murdoch provide to Parliament?
Well,
can they be helpful in preventing something like this from happening in the near future?
Well,
and what is the U.S. going to gain from it when he comes
back?
Well,
I mean, if you look at the answers he gave today, and on top of the fact you look at the testimony that Sir Paul Stevenson gave, the former head of Metropolitan Police, former head of Scotland Yard. You look at the answers he gave. Everybody above the rank of desk editor is claiming culpable deniability in this. But as leadership, we've also talked about the fact that hey, they've got to have an understanding. They've got to have a knowledge of what's going on. And if they're in command at all, they've got to know. But I still go back to the question of, depending on the answers that they gave, today say, look, we had no idea. We had no knowledge of what was going on. When we did, we took decisive action. One of the items that they talked about today in the parliamentary hearing was that Rupert Murdoch, they asked the question, when did you make the decision? Do you regret the decision, rather, to shut down News of the World? He said, no, we had to do it. It was something we had to do.
When people start getting indicted, they may be willing to offer more evidence.
They've already arrested the top person at News Corp International, Rebecca Brooks. So
but they may cop a deal with her in exchange for
Somebody's going to turn if it's anything like the United States.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know the British system well enough, but somebody's going to turn.
One of the great comments today out of the parliamentary hearing was done by a labor member named Tom Watson. He told John Murdoch, quote, "Your father is responsible for corporate governance. And serious wrongdoing has been brought about in this company," basically putting the responsibility and the fault at the foot of the head of the organization, Rupert Murdoch. But, look, we've all been in areas of leadership. You trust, you empower your people. There is a certain sort of fog of war, if you will, when you're leading an organization, especially a multi-billion-dollar organization like News Corp. You're running stuff in Australia, Europe, North America. That's got to have – you can't manage and know the day-to-day goings-on of everybody happening at that time. So, again, the question is this a fair indictment of Rupert Murdoch? It still begs the question, at least I think. Also want to talk about the fact that the number of people that are getting called into this, there is a sense of cover up, or at least talk of cover up, involving number 10 Downing Street and News Corp. Prime Minister David Cameron met with both Rebecca Brooks and senior leadership at News Corp International no less than 26 times in the past 15 days before the discovery of the scandal. Is this enough to possibly, is this Watergate-ish enough to make an impact on number 10 Downing Street? Bob?
I would be very surprised if it didn't.
Really?
I think it's already made an impact. I mean, you know, Cameron is already basically saying, mea culpa, you know, I maybe made some mistakes in hiring people and whatnot and close to people. He's trying to protect himself.
And we've got a phone call from the 727 area code. 727, you're on the air. They didn't want to go on the air.
Maybe it was Murdoch.
It could have been. It could have been News Corp. They were hacking our dashboard here in backroom politics.
As long as Murdoch continues to deny and behave in a very arrogant manner, it's going to go bad for him. He's got to be a little more contrite and remorseful and apologetic to gain public support and sympathy for his case.
And with respect to the, you know, he delegated, he didn't know, this has been systemic. This has been going on for a long time. I think if he didn't know, it's almost as serious as if he did.
Wow. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the polling numbers that's coming out about Washington in general and some of the interesting views that Americans have about what's going on here in Washington. It's an interesting indictment of politics as usual here in D.C. We're going to take a 3-minute break. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the dialogue right now and talk about some polling numbers that are coming out that are actually quite disturbing right now. We at Backroom Politics use real clear polls as a good determination of the averages of all the polling institutions whether you look at Quinnipiac, whether you look at Marist, whether you look at AP, ABC, NBC. But the reality is, when you look at the averages of all, of them all, the big one that stands out right now is the congressional job approval. As of the latest numbers right now, we have a congressional job approval rating of 19.2% of Americans approve of the job that Congress is doing. 73% of Americans believe that they are not doing a good job. That is a huge spread. I got to ask you, Bob, being in Congress as many years as you were, can Congress dig themselves out of this hole at all?
I was never in Congress.
Well, all right, let me rephrase that for you.
I refuse.
As many years as you were involved with the congressional body, when you look at all that, can Congress dig itself out of that hole, or are they too deep in?
No, you can always dig yourself out of a hole if you stop digging and you start doing something. This is probably as bad as I've seen it. It was certainly worse than anything I've seen when many, many years ago when I was a staff person on the Hill. It's much more serious now. But I have to remind us all that, you know, 40 years ago, and that's what we're talking about, when people like Jerry Ford and Hale Boggs and Tip O'Neill were leaders of the Congress, and Bob Michael and John Rhodes, you didn't have the kind of deep, disastrous, long-term, you know, everybody shooting at everybody else. Everybody was in their bunker shooting at the other side and throwing hand grenades. You had deal cutting that got solutions to problems, most of the time before we got to the end. And I think today, let's face it, 6 months ago, the public didn't see this debt ceiling as a great big issue. But day after day after day, you know, the drip, drip, drip of are they going to get a solution? And people have, I think, slowly come to the realization that it's a serious problem if we don't find a way to be able to pay our bills. And that's what it comes down to. We've got a credit card with a bill of $14 trillion plus on it, and we got to pay. This is not future spending we're talking about. This is paying for what we've already spent, and we've got to pay up. And I think that most people have begun to realize that it's a serious problem, and once they realize that, I think they have come to the conclusion that Congress just isn't doing its job. And I think whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you may blame the other side, but you do see the Congress is not doing the job they ought to be doing.
Well, this is disheartening because I think those numbers are probably right. I know lots of good members in Congress right now that I think are working as hard as they can. But this is the wrong fight. The debt ceiling should be approved, and we should have a legitimate discussion about entitlements, a legitimate discussion about tax reform, and we should have a legitimate discussion about how big we want our government to be and what we want them to do. Nothing could be healthier than that. And if you had that conversation and if you disagreed about it or agreed about it, I think that would be the best way to get the respect back. It's the right debate on the wrong vehicle.
Really? What do you think, Ralph?
Well, I think this is the first time we've had a serious debate on our raising the debt ceiling and our getting our fiscal situation in order. I think at the end of the day, both sides have to come together and compromise for the future of our country.
Is it something that, again, we've asked this question before, we've never really gotten a definitive answer, but again, I go back to the question, is this something that, are these numbers that are resonating through the halls of Congress?
I think that the members of Congress know what the polls are. I think they know that there is an increasing angst in the public's mind, and I think the more they understand it, the better off it is for coming to a decision.
But when you look at the job approval ratings, but you look at some of the individual members, it's almost like the individual members, and they look at some of their approval ratings. I mean, there are some that have some very strong approval ratings. I know of three or four that are upwards of 55%.
That's a great old phrase. I hate Congress, but I love my congressman.
Right. So the question is, I mean, are the members of Congress, they see this 19.7% approval rating, do they sit there and go, well, wait a minute, that's not my problem because my people love me?
they're going to first take that approach. But if things continue to get worse and no compromise is reached, you're going to see an attitude among the American people, we just want a clean house.
But it strikes me that with those type of numbers, that and you look at the numbers for the president, you know, the president now down to 46%. When you look at the president and Congress as a whole, those numbers would say, look, we don't approve of what the current environment is in Washington. It's almost like they're begging for change.
Well, and Obama needs to get independence. That was the key to his victory in 2008. He lost support among independents. Now he needs to get that group back in line, and I think depending on how he resolves the situation, it's going to go well. It could go well for him.
First of all, we need to make a distinction. You can't compromise the debt ceiling. It's money that's got to be paid. What you have to do is compromise the other issues that have been attached to that, inappropriately, I think. Secondly, we had change in 2008. We had change in 2010. I'm not so sure that change helps this problem. I mean, we have to find a way to restore, you know, a national debate in which people don't hate each other. And, you know, I hope this program makes some small contribution to that.
Bob?
I wanted to comment about a point John made just a few moments ago, that this is these issues with respect to expenditures and programs that need to be reduced. And he says this isn't the appropriate place for it. And he's right. This is not the appropriate place. The debt ceiling should be something that you do because it's just in the normal course of business. We've got bills to pay, and we ought to pay our bills. The reason that this stuff is here is because as government has gotten bigger over a number of administrations, as we've had the money's going out and not enough money coming in to pay the bills, nobody, as we say, we've heard it 100 times, we keep kicking the problem down the road. A whole lot of folks a couple of years ago ran for Congress saying, in effect, we got to stop kicking the can down the road. These are the Tea Party people. And God love them. They're what they are doing, and it's the reality for them that, you know, they're not, most of them are not professional politicians. They haven't been county commissioners or mayors. These are business people and citizens who just rose up and said, I'm aggravated, I don't want to take it anymore. And they got elected for that reason. And so they're here. And they're not as sophisticated, possibly, as experienced, maybe is a better word, in the ways of Washington. And they have just kind of, you know, upset some apple carts. And one of their apple carts they've upset is, we are going to attach, because it's the only way we can get it on the agenda, we're going to attach our program to the debt ceiling. Now, the problem with that is it's scaring the hell out of the international banking world, the financial world, and it may just bring the government to a halt if we're not careful. It is maybe not the best place to bring it up, but they felt they were going to do it. And we're going to have to solve, at least on a beginning basis, we're going to have to get into those problems and begin the solving of them right now, because the Tea Party will not let anything pass that doesn't give them some start of relief.
Ralph.
And you're correct when you talk about getting people upset and overseas, because my sources abroad are telling me it's these Tea Party people. They're the source of all this problem. Why can't they work with the other side and come together and compromise? And they don't have a lot of respect for the Tea Party people.
John, you had a comment.
Every time I have one of these conversations about the polls and the respect of Congress, and I worry about the Tea Party, I do the same thing. I go back and read Federalist 10. Our founding fathers deliberately wanted to avoid the tyranny of the majority. I know these people are wanting to change things. It's not easy to change things. It's not supposed to be easy to change things. At the moment, the Republican Party, where I have many friends, has the majority of one house of one branch of government. These guys who want to make change, they need to come here. They need to learn how to do it. They don't have to get, quote, corrupted, close quote. Come here, learn how to do it, learn how to be effective, stick with it and work for change.
So
you can't just show up and say, do it my way or I'm going home.
Let
me
jump to be able to effectively govern, and
well,
that's the issue that we
let
have.
Let me jump on something that you just said, though. What is the bigger problem? Is it the process, the culture of Washington, or is it the inexperience of those that are governing?
Why do you have to choose? Both of those are factors.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, right now, the structure of Washington is you know, and this goes back to one of the founding thoughts of the first Congress Society. We have got, for reasons we don't need to go into right here, a very ideologically divided country. And there are a lot of reasons for that, going from redistricting the way it's done to the kind of media we have where the cable media are way over on the left or way over on the right. It moves the public to the right and to the left, and it moves the politics from the to the right and the left rather than to the middle.
Well,
and so we have a problem in trying to get solutions, because so many people are ideologically driven to believe that they have to be my way or the highway.
But let me throw this out there to you. When you look at, when you say that, you know, we have such a divided country right now, that the issues that make this country so divided in the way that they look at Washington, it almost seems like that gap is what is bringing everybody together. I mean, you've got 6 in 10 people being polled on average saying they don't like the direction. 63% of Americans polled don't like the direction of the country that we're going in right now. That brings a lot of people together, and 73% don't believe that Congress is doing a good job.
People are fed up with the backbiting and the discourse in Congress. They want solutions. They want the problem solved. And that was supposed to be the message of the last election.
Yeah.
Was that you need to elect people who are going to come in. They're going to try and work with both sides and solve the problems that America faces.
But one of the problems is that they want to solve the problems, but too many of them say, it's my way. I have the way I want it solved is the way it should be solved. And another group says, no, it's the other side of the coin. And and we don't have enough of a meeting of the minds in solving with a compromise solution. We have too many people wanting it my way 100%.
But, John?
People are also hurting. I mean, this is a lingering economic problem, has caused real pain. I mean, don't I read the other day, 20% of the mortgages are underwater. I don't believe the 9.3% unemployment rate covers everybody. I mean, people are hurting, and they're feeling it, and they're going to express a negativity towards anybody who happens to be in charge. I think this is an extremely difficult time for our country. I really believe that.
Let me ask a question, and I'm not going to go on age with you, Bob. I'm going to go on experience. Are we in a worse time than we were, say, during the Hoover years of the late 20s, early 30s?
You think I know about Hoover?
Yeah. No, but you are a man of history. You are somebody who does look at the historical trends of what was then and what could be. You do have a good insight into that.
We are not nearly, as a country, in as deep a problem, as deep a hole, if you will, economically, than we were in the early 30s and in almost up to the war, the beginnings of World War II. I mean, we were there for 6-8 years in real problems with many, many more, as a larger percentage, many more people out of work as a percentage of the population, many more people who were not able to put, you know, keep their families together and take care of their kids. It was a much more difficult time. We're not nearly that bad off right now. Now, assume we go into a debt. Let's assume we default. We don't get a solution. And let's assume the Congress still refuses to do anything, even refuse to let the president default for us without having the Congress to get involved so they can duck. But the fact of the matter is we'd have to have something at least that bad to say we're as difficult as we were in the middle 30s. So it's not nearly that bad. Hopefully it will not even get close to it. But it's still as bad a situation as anyone who's an adult today has ever seen.
I think the key is for the American people to believe that our country has a future, that their kids and their grandkids are going to inherit a vibrant economy where people can achieve the American dream. In China, you don't have that issue. The parents and the young people believe that their country is moving in the right direction, that they are going to achieve a tremendous amount of success, the country on the move. In the U.S., there's still a mindset among people. They're concerned about the future. They're unsure what's going to happen. They're going to be able to make the mortgage payments. They're going to have health insurance. They're going to find a job. So this is a real important issue that we have to address, this mindset among people about how great our country is going to be. Do we have a future?
And that's where the split starts. Some people think the government should come in and help and solve it. Some people think the government's the problem. Some people think they need more benefits. Some people think we shouldn't pay benefits. That's where the split starts, right where Ralph left it. And we are in disagreement, like Bob said.
Well, we're going to continue to be in disagreement. I mean, what's striking to me is the lack of faith that the American people have in the way that they are governed right now. And that is a very decisive fact. I mean, these numbers are almost historical. We have not seen approval ratings. I've never seen in my years in politics approval ratings where 3/4 of the Americans think that we are in a bad way.
We are in a bad way, but what's the alternative to the Congress? What's the alternative to the presidency? What's the alternative to having a republic and a representative democracy?
You've
got to think about that, too.
In other countries, you'd see a real revolution, but not in our country. We will use the democratic process to make changes.
Bob, do you think the compromise, if there had been almost a sense of compromise being promoted here in Washington, that might affect the numbers more in the positive?
Well, certainly. Look, we're working toward a compromise right now. That's what the Gang of Six is doing. It's a compromise. There's going to be cuts in benefits and in entitlement programs and other expenditures of the government, and they're going to raise some revenues. So all of that that's a compromise. They could, they should have done it months ago, but they didn't. They didn't because the deep split philosophically in the Congress that reflects the American public's view. And it's a deeply split country about how the government should operate. And unfortunately, it's taken us right down to the cliff before we get everybody too scared to go forward without a compromise.
John,
but the no action alternative isn't going to make anything better.
Well,
no.
but John, I was going to pose this question to you: is when we look at what's out there, when we look at two different factions, the sense of compromise. Could a solid message, if the White House had come out with a solid message 6 months ago that we are coming to some sort of resolution, we are going to work together, there will be compromise, do you think that these numbers would be different now if the president had gotten more involved 6 months ago?
No. First of all, there's not two factions. If you look closely, there's 50 factions. There are two parties. Two, I think this fight was inevitable. I think the new group that came in was spoiling for this fight, and now we have it. And three, I think we've reached the tipping point. I think it's going to get resolved, and it's time for grown-ups to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? We are hurting. What are we going to do?
And ultimately, it's up to the American people to decide what they're going to do. They're
right.
going to hold their feet to the fire and force them to provide solutions.
Right.
Well, and I think they're holding the feet to the fire when, if you take a look at a poll that shows 77% of the public thinks that the government isn't doing what they ought to be doing and Congress is not doing what they ought to be doing, that's holding the feet to the fire. I mean, that's telling a whole lot of people in Congress, we're not doing what the public wants, and the public happens to vote for it.
Well, we're going.
So what are we going to do, throw them all out again?
Probably, if it gets much worse, yeah.
Well, the funny thing about it is when you talk to some people in Congress, there is talk that we could see another radical swing in the House in 2012,
absolutely.
Another radical swing in the Senate in 2012, and possibly a radical swing in the White House. That being said, that's got hopefully, and this goes back to one of the mantras that we talked about with First Congress Society, is that hopefully this will stimulate people to get more involved. This will stimulate people to get more active in taking a personal interest in how they're governed, which is something that we've seen. Again, we've said this numerous times amongst ourselves and numerous times on this program. We are now in an electorate that is not only lazy and complacent, but they're uninformed. They're not finding the right information to themselves. That's a problem.
People,
that's a huge
people
problem.
People are starting to hurt economically, so they are going to take a more active voice in how their government is
Well, we hope so.
I think a lot of people don't think the government should be involved in their problems economically or otherwise. I don't agree with you, respectfully.
Really? Why
at all? Because I think a lot of people hate the government, and they think government's the problem.
But they all want... But they all want their Social Security checks, and they want their Medicare.
I get it.
Well,
by the way, I think maybe for another day, the most interesting political ramifications are in the Senate races, which are extremely close, and
right.
We give the Republicans another out. And at some point... Mr. Moderator, when you'd like to discuss that, it would be a fun conversation.
Yeah, we may bring that up. We may bring that up in the next couple of weeks. It's not a bad idea, John. When we come back, we're going to have a quick lesson in political Yiddish. We're going to talk about the correct way to say certain phrases. If you're going to call it out, kids, at least say it correctly. We'll cover that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Backroom, the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics here in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're coming into the home stretch for this edition of Backroom Politics. And we know, because we are an organization of getting the correct information out there, because we are a group that believes that if you're going to bring something out, at least use it in the right context. Use it. John,
Before you start, I just want to say it's a little bit like wine. You know, I love Chablis and Merlot, but I'm not sure that I always get it when I order it.
Wow. Which leads us to the next topic here on Backroom Politics. Over the weekend on Fox News Sunday, presidential candidate and still congresswoman from Minnesota,
Michelle Bachmann.
My God.
The babe.
Michelle Bachmann was on Fox News this Sunday and was talking about President Obama and how he had, and I'm going to spell the word for you so you know what we're talking about. The word is spelled C-H-U-T-Z-P-A-H. Now then, I'm going to go around the table. John, how do you say that word?
Chutzpah.
No, that's Michelle Bachmann. Apparently.
Chutzpah.
There we go. Bob, how do we say that?
Chutzpah.
Ralph?
Chutzpah.
Okay. Now then, I have in front of me here in the smoking crusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. I have actually gone. There is a website called HebrewForChristians.com.
All right.
www.HebrewForChristians.com. Okay, which I think, you know, look, there's not a member of Congress that doesn't have a Jewish community in, and if you're from New York, if you're 55, you're automatically Jewish. I mean, that you say this stuff on a daily basis. According to Hebrew for Christians, it is pronounced chutzpah. It is a noun. It means nerve, insolence, presumption, and arrogance, as in, according to Michelle Bachmann, the president has a lot of chutzpah. Now then, there are other words that we use in political lingo today. First of all, I got to go around the table. Bob, in your years of being here in Washington, I'm sure you've heard a lot of Yiddish phrases. They use it in political rhetoric all the time, especially when you're talking to your Jewish electorate. It should be something if you're going to use it. It's like going to France. You know, I understand it's nice to try, but you should at least make a valid attempt at it and don't try and pull it out of your ear. Bob, you've seen this a lot, I take it, Yiddish in politics and being misused?
Of course. It's SOP on Capitol Hill. Everybody uses Hebrew phrases, Jewish phrases. It's normal. It's everyday politics.
Well, that being the case, when you look at... Now, what's that? Everybody's around the table going.
I got one.
Wait. John, you have a word that you've heard in political rhetoric. What's the word?
Oh, Bob Hines is a real good guy. He's a regular mensch.
He stole mine. Well, then you know again. That is something that we do here. You know, he is a real mensch.
He stole my word.
And by the way, John, for your knowledge, that is the correct. You used the incorrect terms. And according to Hebrew for Christians, mensch is a noun, one who does good deeds, a good guy, as in, he's a real mensch, the kind of guy you can always count on. Plural is mensch. Okay, interesting. Bob, you got one?
Well, there's a lot of people I know who I would call schmucks.
Schmucks! Let's go. Now then. Wow. Not being now then, okay. It is not something that we would condone using because we do condone what's the word I'm looking for? Civility. That's it. But when you look at the word, wow, wait a minute, you know what? They do not have that. Schmuck is not in.
What about putt?
Wow, this is amazing. We will look at putts. Let's look at the word putts. Plots, we've heard everybody say, I could just plot, as in, my God, the congressman, what he said today, I could just plot. Let's see, what else do we have in there? Putts. Ah, it is in there. According to Hebrew for Christians. Now then, I'm hoping that everybody in Washington who's listening to this, and as everybody jokes, it could be 3-4 people on the Hill. If you're on the Hill and you're talking to your member, please allow them to use this in context. It's respective. It really is respectful. Putt. Now we've heard this. Wow, the guy who is from Michigan, he's a real putz. That is a noun. It is a pejorative. It is used to describe a nasty, unlikable man, someone who has no real power except to make your life miserable or at least unpleasant. Wow, this even the website is a little Yiddish. That's amazing.
I have one.
Go ahead.
Shlemiel.
Shlemiel. Shlemiel. Again, if you're going to use it,
I said Shlemiel.
Shlemiel. Well, that's not what we heard.
Well, you have a hearing problem.
Let's see. Shlemiel. Shlemiel is a noun, and it is a fool, a fumbler, a dolt, a clumsy person, as in to say, my God, the representative from this state is a real Shlemiel. My God, that is amazing. There are so many of these things, and the reason why I bring it up is because, you know, this just brings up everyone on the liberal media side. MSNBC just drove on this. They still show this. Even the late night talk shows are talking about that.
Is it fair? I don't think we should be so hard on Michelle Bachmann, though. I don't think mispronouncing a Hebrew word rises to the level of talking about how our founding fathers worked very hard to stop slavery, which, of course, they didn't. They owned slaves.
Does the attack on it almost seems like the attack on Michelle Bachmann that the media is are just they want to kvetch, which, by the way, according to Hebrew profession, kvetch means to gripe, complain, or to bemoan one's fate. They just want to sit there and kvetch.
This will have absolutely no impact on her campaign. I would suspect that she has very few members of the Hebrew faith who are her supporters, and it has nothing to do with the fact that she doesn't pronounce the words correctly. It has to do with the policies that she recommends and believes in.
Right.
But, you know, she should have known better. She spent a summer on a kibbutz.
Wow, let's look at Kibbutz.
Yes, she did.
Did she really?
She did, yes.
Are you kidding me?
No,
kidding.
I'm not kidding.
A collective car.
Christians United for Israel. One summer, I think it was when she was 17, she spent a summer on a kibbutz, so she should have known better.
Wow, which is funny because that, you know, and while she was at the kibbutz, I'm sure she was readily available to kibbutz. Kibbutz is a verb to chat, gab, mindlessly talk in a socialized and chatty way. So, you know, when, you know, we look at everybody sitting there, you know, Michelle Bachmann makes this mistake, and all of a sudden they kvetch. They sit there and they squeal. They complain or scream, according to Hebrew for Christians. But has the 24-hour news cycle made us so petty that we have to attack Michelle Bachmann for mispronouncing this?
Yes.
Really? Does that?
Yes.
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 Everybody say yes. Everybody
is. I need to tone it down.
Well, I mean, When this makes news, I mean, let's be honest, it's funny. I mean, look, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times, I mean, George W. Bush used to get just ridiculed unmercifully because of some of his, you know, Bushisms. He would put words, even in some instances, makes words up. And you know what? Some of them are now in dictionaries because
strategery,
exactly. You know, you look at strategery as, you know, Saturday Night Live. I mean, I still use strategery as a comic punchline. But the reality is, you know, it's that type of 24-hour media that's really made the American electorate very petty. I mean, you know, we're joking about it now, but it's a very serious topic. Is how do we get, and Bob, being involved in the media as long as you were, how do you get the media to change their stance on little putzy stuff like this?
If I knew that, I'd probably still be working at NBC and try to keep things straight. I have no idea how you can straighten it out. We are in a situation where it is anything that you can find to say about somebody who you would like to demean, you say. and people do it all the time. It's an equal opportunity offender, whether you're a cable channel who believes in the Democratic platform or in the Republican platform. It makes no difference.
John,
with respect to the congressional side of things, part of the problem is how do you show restraint when you get so much ammunition? How could you not run Anthony Weiner? How could you not do that? Just look at his name.
If they bring it on themselves, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it is enough to make you plots, which, according to Hebrew for Christians, is a verb. Means to explode, as in with joy or food. Laugh until you plot.
Oy vey!
Oy vey! Yeah, exactly. Well done. Anyway, thought we'd bring that up. And this has been a public service announcement from Backroom Politics. We're coming in the last 10 minutes of the show. This is our freeform show where we go around the table. Ralph's got one. What do you got?
Okay.
Wait a minute. You're jumping ahead. I got to explain to people what part of the show
this is. All right, go ahead.
This is a part of the show that we go around the table and we talk about hearsay gossip and some rumors, some buzz that's going around Washington, D.C. We try and scoop all the other major media markets, as we've done numerous times before, which proves to people listening to this show. This is Tell Me a Story. Ralph, tell me a story.
The Tim Geithner era is coming to an end. The Obama administration is looking at someone from the corporate sector to replace Geithner.
Wait a minute. We have somebody from the 201 area code. Hold on. 201 area.
Hey, Justin and Freya. If Michelle Bachmann wins the GOP presidential nominee, it's Bestert.
That's my major contribution.
Wow.